Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
On the program today, razor blades, some serious ugliness on Twitter, also higher education and big data. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, 20 July. Today, good as always to have you here, everybody. The economic goings-on in Cleveland, both inside and outside the Quicken Loans Arena, in just a couple of minutes. First, though, how about a little antitrust story, huh? Nothing like digging into the regulatory details, am I right? Out of Washington, D.C. today, this item: all signs are pointing to the U.S. Department of Justice blocking two ginormous proposed health insurance mergers, the $48 billion deal between Anthem and Cigna, as well as the $37 billion tie-up with Aetna and Humana, on the grounds that less competition will drive prices up for consumers. Contra that, the companies say getting bigger is the best way to deliver just what consumers want: higher quality, lower cost care. So from the Health Desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explores the effect these mergers might have on cost and quality of care and innovation in a rapidly changing market.
When it comes to antitrust issues, the U.S. Justice Department's mission is pretty straightforward. Lawyers and economists there are basically deal referees. Tim Graney is a professor at St. Louis University School of Law.
Consumers have essentially an economic right to a competitive market, and things that distort that are illegal.
Now, we don't know for sure what DOJ will do, but it sounds like after kicking the tires, these referees have decided consumers will end up paying a premium on their premiums. An influential study shows past insurance consolidation led to average hikes of 7%. Economist Ted Frack at UC Santa Barbara says another thing to consider is insurance giants like Anthem and Aetna are dominating the game.
A lot of insurance markets already are pretty concentrated. This would make it worse in a lot of markets.
A marketplace analysis of American Medical Association data found the top two insurers control 65% of the market or more in 27 states. Insurers have defended these deals, arguing scale will bring more innovation, like customized plans. Aetna spokesperson Christine Groh says her company has vowed to fight this out in court.
Together, we would have the team, the talent, and the technology to develop those solutions.
Consolidation in the sector is likely to lead to stagnation, not innovation.
Limor Daphne is an economist at the Harvard Business School. She says it's competition that will drive the innovation that's needed now that health insurance has become a mandated product with limited choices.
Try to design plans that are appealing to the tech-savvy crowd, plans that are appealing to young families, plans that suit the needs of empty nesters.
Even if DOJ moves to stop these mergers in the coming days, this fight is just beginning. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
All right, do the math. If you sell razor blades by mail for $1 a piece and a big multinational company wants to buy you, what are you worth? Amazingly enough, something near $1 billion. That is what Unilever is said to have paid for the irreverent online marketing sensation Dollar Shave Club. The question now, though, is whether Unilever can lever this to take on the big boys at Gillette. From Washington Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
4 years ago, it started with a buck a blade and a video.
A dollar. Are the blades any good? No. Our blades are great.
22 million views later, shaving is fun. No more trudging to the drugstore to pay $5 a blade, says analyst Matthew Barry at Euromonitor.
Now Dollar Shave said it doesn't have to be like that. You can have it shipped to you. You can pay a lot less. So, you know, it's not so much that it was just cheaper. It was so much easier.
It's disrupting a business where Gillette and Schick once enjoyed 40% margins. Dollar Shave Key is the subscription. Every month, with your blades, you can order shaving cream, hair product, and, no kidding, baby wipes for men.
Fortunately, there's a better way to wipe your messy bottom. They're called One Wipe Charlies.
Jonah Berger at the Wharton School at Penn is the author of Contagious, Why Things Catch On.
Whether it's actual loyalty or just behavioral loyalty, rather than going to the store and who's ever on sale, you end up picking up that product. By going directly to the consumer with a subscription model, they're locked in.
So Unilever bought. Perhaps most of all, to push into the e-commerce subscription space. Unilever makes Axe deodorant and a lot of grooming products to ship with razors. Deborah Aitken is with Bloomberg Intelligence.
The idea is that they use the know-how that the Dollar Shave Club has built up over the last 4 years to really understand how the market works and probably to replicate this model.
For now, it's just a promising model. For all the hype, Dollar Shave Club is still waiting to turn a profit. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Another day, another record. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's day three of the GOP festivities in Cleveland. The Republican National Convention will hear from vice presidential nominee Mike Pence tonight. It's also day three of our pop-up podcast, Politics Inside Out. This convention, politics, and the economy from both the insider and outsider point of view. One of the questions we had for convention goers was this: what is your biggest personal economic concern these days, and do you think Donald Trump is the one to fix it? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer waded right on into the crowd to ask.
Trade deficits, I mean, that is disastrous for our country. So these cheap goods that are coming into this country that everybody's getting addicted to are destroying our country. We need to start doing manufacturing here. We need to be able to start producing.
As far as trade goes, are you in sync with Donald Trump?
I don't think you can just pull a plug on something like that. We got to come up with a plan that keeps us fiscally responsible and also helps our friends and trading partners.
Safety. If you cannot be safe on your way to school, if you cannot be safe in your own home, if you can't be safe on your way to work or at the workplace, what are you doing? You cannot live your life. You cannot produce, you cannot create, you cannot think.
And so the second part of that question is Donald Trump the person who can fix that, who can deliver that for us?
Of the two candidates we have before us as Americans, he is the better suited to preserve and protect our safety.
I think taxes, most especially, letting people keep more of their own money. I personally am a proponent of the fair tax or flat tax. I know they're two different things, but either one of them would be better than an income tax.
And do you think Trump is the guy to do that?
We'll see.
That was Mark Bossy of Long Island, New York. Jean Kangas, she's a delegate from Massachusetts. Also, Bo Staples of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Also, give a listen to our podcast, Politics Inside Out. You can subscribe wherever you choose to subscribe to your podcasts. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew is in Athens today meeting with the Prime Minister and Finance Minister to see what progress Greece has made in reforming its economy. A year ago, as we told you when we did the broadcast from Athens last summer, international creditors were demanding changes. Higher taxes, less public spending in exchange for a bailout, Greece's third bailout in point of fact. There was even talk at the time, although it seems like long ago now, of Greece being forced out of the Eurozone. While we were there, we talked to a whole bunch of people doing their best to get by as Greece seemed to be falling apart. Marketplace's Stephen Beard went back not too long ago to find out how some of those folks are doing now.
A street musician plays a rather mournful tune in Syntagma Square. It suits the prevailing mood. His tin is empty. And across the road, in a flower shop underneath the Parliament building, florist Spiros Kontogiannis voices a familiar lament. Business is bad.
I'm on the edge. I think I don't make money. I just survive. But I know next year I will lose.
So what will you do then?
I don't know. To tell you the truth, I don't know.
His flower business has been crushed by ever-rising taxes and shrinking consumer purchasing power.
It's like somebody is strangling us. It's like we have no hope. You cannot live like that. It's a matter of time that many small businesses will close.
Greece, he says, is trapped in a downward spiral, locked inside a currency it cannot control, dictated to by its more powerful partners in the European Union.
Would you like to pull out, then?
I think there's no other way right now. There is no other alternative for Greece.
I've come a few blocks away from the flower shop for a very different perspective.
I see my company grow, so I'm optimistic.
Vanis Katuvalis launched this software company in the teeth of the financial crisis.
I think this turbulence of the economy and the market is could be an opportunity for some people to take more risks.
The company sells software to help small, hard-pressed retailers cut their costs. It's raised $2.5 million in capital, employs 26 people, seems to be prospering, and is planning to launch in the U.S. next year. Katuvalis says the crisis, with its soaring youth unemployment, has been, frankly, a boon.
Because you have a lot of talent, a lot of young web developers, and the cost, the payroll cost, is almost half of what we should would have to pay in New York, for example, for an engineer.
Greece clearly needs more young entrepreneurs like Katuvalis, many more. As the crisis grinds on, youth unemployment still runs at more than 50%. In Athens, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up,
45% of the students that start in higher education are not finishing.
Yeah, that's a problem. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 36 points today, a tenth percent, 18,595. The Nasdaq pocketed 53 points, about 1%, 5,089. The S&P 500 captured 9 points, 0.4%, ended things at 21.73. The earnings palooza marches on. Microsoft shares clicked up more than 5% today. That after yesterday's strong earnings report. The tech giant not only lifted the Dow, it drove up other tech shares as well. Cisco up 2.3%. Barbie appears to be making a comeback. Her new assortment of body shapes, tall, curvy, and petite, helped lift sales 23% last quarter. Mattel shares thus up 1.4%. Outside the earnings bubble, Walt Disney offloaded 1.25% after shares were downgraded. 21st Century Fox, which had been grappling with the Roger Ailes scandal, took a hit of close to 3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Leslie Jones should have had a really good weekend celebrating the release of her new movie, Ghostbusters. Instead, she spent it dealing with some really, really horrible abuse on Twitter and wound up on Monday night quitting the social media platform. Twitter responded to the abuse in part by banning a guy by the name of Milo Yiannopoulos. He's an editor at the conservative news site Breitbart. They banned him for leading the attacks on Jones. Yiannopoulos had been heckling his way toward banishment for a while now. His account had been suspended a couple of times. But in a parting shot yesterday, he claimed that Twitter would suffer for what he characterized as its attack on free speech. And that gets us to this. Twitter is really still trying to figure out where it stands, for its original ideals or with its bottom line. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
The messages that Leslie Jones received on Twitter were beyond vile. Racist and sexist really doesn't even begin to describe them. As Jones said in her final tweet, all this because I did a movie. This is the ugly side of the same free platform that facilitated the Arab Spring and hashtag Black Lives Matter.
Twitter has talked big talk about free speech before. It's kind of in their corporate identity.
Sarah Jong is a lawyer and contributing editor at Motherboard.
The free speech wing of the Free Speech Party. That's an actual quote from a Twitter executive.
But over the years, Twitter's initially sparse terms of service have become much more restrictive. Lawsuits, terrorism, and most visibly, harassment have all chipped away at Twitter's original Wild West approach.
They're trying to reconcile their free speech roots with the interest of keeping their platform usable.
For some users, like the band editor Milo Yiannopoulos, free speech is paramount, but
the majority of Twitter users probably are not as vested in that.
Ross Rubin directs industry analysis at App Annie. In the case of Leslie Jones, Twitter made a high-profile example of enforcing its policies and in a statement said it hadn't done enough in the past. Its enforcement of what's allowed certainly hasn't been as rigorous as that of other platforms like Instagram or Facebook. Michael Pachter is a research analyst at Wedbush Securities. He says Twitter needs to do more if it wants to increase its user base.
And they're more likely to achieve that goal if Twitter is safe. If you go on the first time and you see people, you know, slamming one another's race or sex or whatever, it's not comfortable.
And, of course, in the end, Twitter is a business, not a government.
You know, the Constitution doesn't apply to them. They can censor whatever the hell they feel like censoring.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The unemployment rate in this country is 4.9%. That is item one. Item two is that NASA and the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration confirmed yesterday that the first half of this year has been the hottest the planet has ever seen. You roll those two into one and you get, among many other things, yes, but for our purposes today, you get this. Landscaping companies say they are having a real tough time finding American workers to hire, especially for the jobs that by definition have to be done outside in the sun and record heat. Alexia Fernandez-Campbell is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She wrote all about this recently. Alexia, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
There is a fact of immigration law, a quirk in immigration law that we need to discuss here. The difference between H-2B visas and then H-2A visas, right?
Right. So I think what, you know, is probably most well known is the H-2A program. It's the agricultural temporary guest worker program that's always up in the immigration debate. There's farmers saying that they don't have enough people who want to be outside picking vegetables or peaches. And that is probably the best known guest worker program. But this one, the H-2 B visa program, is not as well known. And it's really also temporary. It's for, you know, businesses that need seasonal work, but it's not in the out in the farms.
How hard is it for landscaping companies who want to do the right thing to actually act in accordance with immigration law?
Well, when I was speaking with one man who's in charge of recruiting for a huge landscaping company that maintains golf courses, I was just like, I was completely shocked by the process. He explained it to me, and it involves three federal agencies, one state, thousands of dollars per request, and you have to let the state know which jobs you're requesting, and you have to advertise for them. And here's an interesting thing. You have to hire anyone who applies who seems like even remotely qualified for the job. And then after you advertise for 10 days, then you go back to the Labor Department and say, look, this is how many people I still need. And then so they approve that, and you have to go through U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services and then get a visa for those workers. And then they have to go interview at the State Department and the consulates in their country and pass background checks. And, I mean, that's what it really takes if you want to play by the rules,
right.
I guess.
Is there any part of this that is a wage issue? Landscaping, as you say in the article, is a $76 billion a year business growing by plus or minus 3% a year. It would seem there's some headroom for better wages.
Right. So, you know, one of the things I was wondering, I was like, wouldn't it be easier to just pay people more and you'd maybe be able to find more Americans willing to work? And that didn't seem to be a popular solution, especially with the one of the recruiters that I spoke to, and he said, well, you know, we're already paying twice the minimum wage, which is $15 an hour in one case. And, you know, we have to stay competitive, but I don't know, maybe it would be easier to just pay instead of $15 an hour, maybe $20 an hour.
Well, and then that comes to the Americans who want people to mow their lawns and do their landscaping. I'm not talking just the professional landscapers on golf courses, but as you say in this piece, Americans spend $600 a year to have somebody mow their lawns.
Yeah, I was surprised about that. I mean, I definitely don't, you know, spend that much money. I, you know, my husband does that. But I didn't realize that that many Americans were just deciding, you know what, I'm not going to mow my lawn. I'm going to have someone else do it. And then so it creates this demand for landscaping jobs that apparently the labor force can't fill.
Right. And Americans apparently are not willing to pay more, right?
Apparently not.
Alexia Fernandez-Campbell writes for The Atlantic Magazine. Her piece is called Many Americans Want to Work, But They Don't Want to Mow Lawns. Alexia, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Every now and then in this job, I run across a statistic that makes me go, huh, here's one of them. There are more than 30 million people in this country who have gone to college but left school without finishing their degree. That, in part, explains why colleges are under growing pressure from students and their parents, companies, that is, would-be employers, and also the federal government to do a better job in the graduation department. Also, and not for nothing, but lousy graduation rates can do a number on a school's position in those all-important college rankings. So, like a lot of businesses these days, higher ed is turning to big data to better understand which students leave and why. One of the bigger education big data companies, Civitas Learning it's called, is out with some of its findings today. From the education desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott got an early look.
About a year and a half ago, Angela Baldessare and some colleagues at the University of Arizona were gathered in front of a big screen, clicking through a series of charts and graphs. She's assistant provost of institutional research.
And as we were toggling through different segments of our student population, we started to see this trend.
That a lot of students with good grades, B averages and higher, weren't coming back after their first year.
So we were looking at each other and we're looking at the screen and we're realizing, wow, you know, this actually changes everything.
Everything? Because the university hadn't considered students at risk of dropping out unless they had a 2.0, a C average, or lower.
And that means we're missing a whole lot of students in the middle who really need more support.
It turns out that was happening at a lot of other colleges, too. Laura Malcolm is a vice president at Civitas Learning, which makes the data analytics tool the university was using. Malcolm has been sifting through data from 55 different colleges and universities. Civitas is releasing some of the findings today.
And we found that, on average, 42% of students who are leaving these institutions have GPAs over a 3.0.
That's better than a B average.
And 33% from 2.0 to 3.0.
In all, Malcolm found 3/4 of students who leave without a degree have decent grades. Now, some of those students will end up finishing college somewhere else. But nationally,
45% of the students that start in higher education are not finishing.
That's Mark Milliron, co-founder and chief learning officer of Civitas.
So the idea is if we can use this data to move the needle, even just 3 to 5% per institution, you're talking about adding 1 million more students per year.
And we got into this building, they wouldn't let us put any signage on the outside.
Milliron recently showed me around the company's fast-growing headquarters in downtown Austin, where young engineers with laptops lounge on sofas and these big, soft, squishy...
That's the kind of thing they put under the ski lift so no one breaks a bone on the floor.
The big throw pillows.
Throw pillows, that's the word.
We're competing with Google, Dropbox, Oracle, and other folks for data scientists and engineers. And part of our pitch is we want people to be excited about working with us and the idea of using their powers for good. Right?
Come Milliron says schools are sitting on tons of useful data, from grades and test scores to financial aid status, but it's in umpteen different systems. Civitas pulls all that information together to discover, for instance, that how often students interact with online course materials and discussion boards is highly predictive of whether they'll make it to the next term. So are certain classes, like freshman writing, where students who get C's are much less likely to graduate. The next step is figuring out what to do with the findings.
And there are some questions that we can only answer, like the why questions, by talking to our students.
Again, Angela Baldessari at the University of Arizona. She says a disproportionate number of students who were doing well academically but still leaving were female and from out of state. The university found out a lot of them were homesick, so it started a summer bridge program to help them adjust. That wasn't 20-year-old Trista Carson's problem, even though she'd come all the way from Barberton, Ohio in the fall of 2014.
It was a great and amazing experience. I wish I was still there.
Trista hadn't realized she needed at least a 2.5 GPA to keep one of her scholarships. Her first semester grades fell short, and taking out more loans wasn't an option.
I never had a meeting or anything with an advisor about any of my financial situations. No one had reached out to me until after I had left.
Today, a student like Trista would be on the university's radar earlier and more likely to get support. Instead, she went back home to Ohio. She's now a junior at the University of Akron. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of what could possibly go wrong. A new partnership between Ford and Jose Cuervo. Yes, Jose Cuervo, the tequila Jose Cuervo. Turns out once the tequila is made, there is a bunch of really fibrous agave plant stuff left over. Ford says it could use it to make wiring harnesses or cup holders, maybe. Interestingly enough, Ford already uses soy foam, castor oil, wheat straw, coconut fiber, and rice hulls in its cars. Me? I drink beer. Hey, look at the time. Gotta go. The Dow Industrial's up 36 points today, about a 10%, 18,595. The NASDAQ up 53 points, about a percent, 5,089. The S&P 500, 9 points higher, 0.4%. Ended things at 21.73. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.